This week we're going to be reading Parshas Behalosecha. I'm going to mute everybody. You can unmute yourself if you have a question, okay? Parshas Behalosecha, which is an important parsha in the scheme of the narrative of the Torah. I mean, every parsha is important in the scheme of the narrative of the Torah, but it's important in the sense that it's a significant transition. Up until now, up until Parshas Behalosecha, we basically had, in terms of the narrative of the tale, so with the exception of the setback that was brought about by the golden calf, the Bnei Yisrael, basically, they had gotten through whatever adventures they needed to get through in order to get to Har Sinai. And at Har Sinai, they got the Torah. I mean, obviously, I mentioned the golden calf, so that was a little bit of a setback, but it wasn't an eternal kind of setback. What happened after that was the building of the Mishkan, and after the Mishkan was built and dedicated, shortly thereafter, as we saw at the beginning of the book of Bamidbar, it was time to move. And the idea of the move is that we're moving on to the Holy Land. And how long that was supposed to take, you know, the Torah doesn't really tell us that. It does tell us in the book of Devarim, those who are in the Devarim class, at the very beginning of our class, we saw how in the book of Devarim, where they are at the end of Moshe's life is Achar Asar Yomei Chorev, which is an 11 days journey from Chorev. Okay, so Chorev is Har Sinai. So we know how far of a distance, in a sense, I mean, however you define that, Achar Asar Yomei Chorev isn't really a distance. It's not a defined distance, but it means an 11 days journey. So, you know, 11 days journey by whose pace of travel? What does an 11 days journey mean in terms of distance? So I can't answer that question. I don't know. But at least insofar as, you know, that time frame, it's not a whole lot of time that it would take for them to get from Chorev to where they are. But we know, with the benefit of hindsight, mostly on account of what's going to happen in next week's parsha, which is the story of the spies, they're going to end up in the wilderness for a sum total of 40 years. So what happens in this parsha are a series of setbacks, primarily in chapter 11. I don't remember if it was an article or a speech or a Dvar Torah that I wrote that, you know, what's chapter 11? Reckoning, right? When you kind of like everything kind of changes. So that's really what happens in Parshas Behalosecha in chapter 11, because the very end of chapter 10 is Vayihi ben Soa Ha'aron Vayomer Moshe. It describes the ideal form of their travel, which is when the Aaron would move, Moshe says, Kuma Hashem v'yafutzo evecha v'yanusa misenecha v'ypanecha, which we say every time we open the ark, but what's Moshe saying? Arise Hashem, let your foes be scattered, let those who hate you flee from before you. And the notion is that the Aaron traveled, and the couple of psukim before this, say it. So it's in chapter 10, pasuk 33 and 34. That the ark was a 3-day journey ahead of them. Again, whatever that means, how much of a distance ahead of them was the ark? So I don't know. Right? If we talk about the journey of a single person, so a single person technically. Right, assuming walking. Listen, I take a walk every now and then, especially on Shabbos. I've been taking these longer walks, so a 3-mile walk for me takes about an hour. Okay, give or take a couple minutes. Right, I imagine for some people it's a similar pace. Maybe some people a little faster. Maybe some people a little slower. But let's assume for a second that that's average. So over the course of 10 hours of travel. Right. Let's assuming that we're not slowing down that pace. You have the opportunity to stop, take a rest, take a break, whatever. 10 hours of travel is 30 miles a day. So what does that mean? The ark is 90 miles ahead of them. Is that what it means? So I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know what Derech Shlosh Yamim means. I don't know what Derech Shlosh Yamim meant when Moshe said to Paro, "Let's go Derech Shlosh Yamim, a 3-day journey." What does a 3-day journey mean? I don't know. When you're talking about one person, right? So maybe one person can cover 30 miles in a day. But when you're talking about 600,000, a couple million people, right? Are they going to cover 30 miles in a day? Not likely. Okay, so what does Derech Shlosh Yamim mean? So I don't know the answer to that question. But the point is that what's indicated here is the way they're supposed to travel and how the enemies are supposed to flee. In other words, God's bulldozing, steamrolling what's the path through the use of the ark. And when at rest, he would say, reside tranquilly, O Hashem, among the myriad thousands of Israel. Okay, so this is, you know, in a sense, the ideal form of travel. Now, just you should know that those two psukim are surrounded by inverted nuns. And if you want to see a nice article on the subject, I would recommend you go to Lyman Library, Professor Schneer Lyman, Lyman Library. And in there, he has a number of articles that he's written. And one of them is, I don't remember which link you click on. I mean, I could navigate it for you, but I don't want to waste the time. And there he has an article about the inverted nuns. He has many articles there. He's a wonderful scholar, very, very brilliant Talmud Chacham, Professor Lyman is. And every article there is worth is worth your time, but in terms of this particular subject of the inverted nuns, so I'm giving you the reference and you can look it up. So that's really the ideal, and everything that comes beforehand is all following in this this plan from Har Sinai to the land of Israel, and then we get to this ideal form of travel, and then we get to chapter 11, and everything changes. Things start to fall apart, right? Because what did we have at Har Sinai? At Har Sinai, we had just an idyllic kind of setting. But you had Har Sinai, so I don't know if anybody's ever been to Cape Town. I've never been to Cape Town, but when I was in Israel, in Yeshiva, one of the fellows there from South Africa was from Cape Town, and he had a big picture of Cape Town on the wall in his dormitory room. And in Cape Town, there's this big mountain. I don't even remember the name of it, but it is beautiful. I mean, it's unbelievable. You look at this, you're like, wow. I mean, that's just fantastic. So I imagine, in a sense, Lahavdil, I don't know if the people were encamped around Har Sinai or if they were encamped kind of, on one side of it, and the way that the Mishkan was set up, they were all, in one side of the Mishkan. But, you can imagine that Har Sinai is kind of in the background or maybe in the center of their existence, even though it's not being used in the same way that it was before. But, it has a history, and it has a memory that people could look at Har Sinai, and it's a source of inspiration, even if they're allowed to climb up on it now, and they were. But, like, wow, this is Har Sinai. This is where Revelation took place. I mean, God was here. And everything that took place on the bottom of the mountain and the memories which they have, including the negative memories of the deaths of Nadab and Abihu, which is relatively fresh in their mind in the scheme of things. So, but there's history, and you feel God's presence, and you know that God is here. And then it's time to pick up, and it's time to go. And again, in the Devarim class, I think it was in Devarim chapter 9, we noted there that there was a river which was coming down from the mountain. Okay, there's a Nachal Hayored Min Ha'har. That's the phrase which appears in the Torah. Lyman is L-E-I-M-A-N. Okay? There was a river there, so in other words, they had a never-ending water supply. Okay, however, that was fed. Was it an underground spring which fed the water? Was it whatever it may have been? So they had water there, and we know that they had man there. Okay, so they had food, but people aren't really thinking about this, I would guess, because it's just they're so busy, they're occupied with the aftermath of the golden calf. Okay, that takes some time to just okay, folks, all right, we'll go outside, we'll take our mun, we're not going to rock the boat, there's water and all that. And then it's all about the building of the Mishkan, which takes several months as well. And then after the Mishkan is dedicated, and they're like, okay, good, now they don't have any more projects. And when you don't have projects, when you don't have work, then what happens? Okay? Well, take a look at what's going on in society today, because people have been stuck in their homes, and I'm not defending what took place in Minneapolis, but when people don't have work to go to, and when they don't have things to look forward to, so, listen, a peaceful protest is one thing. The rioting and the looting is horrible and inexcusable, and we're very familiar with this, because we've seen it in terms of many of the protests, against the IDF and against Israel that we've seen from certain communities who don't have a very high employment rate. And so when you don't have something to do, what do? You join them up. You join them up. And that's what happens here. Okay, Lahavdil. Lahavdil, and I make the distinction. But you have a number of episodes in chapter 11 which are very negative stories. The first one is the just complainers. Okay, what's their complaint? We don't know what their complaint is. They're complaining, and they're a rabble rouser of some kind. And there's a fire which comes to consume them. Now, what's interesting is what's the fire? Who's the fire? What's it all about? There is a theory and a suggestion. I think Rashi even mentions this. Rashi says two opinions. B'ktzei ha-machane, the fire consumed them at the edge of the camp. So Rashi says, b'muktzin shebehen l'shiflus, like he makes a play on words, muktzin shebehen, as opposed to ktzei ha-machane, in other words, people who are the lowest of the low. And who are the lowest of the low? The Erev Rav. So one opinion is the Erev Rav. Now the Erev Rav is a foil, by the way. How many times is the Erev Rav mentioned in the Torah? Once. B'gam Erev Rav Allah Iman, when the Torah says that the Bnei Yisrael left Egypt, it talks about how the Erev Rav went up with them, and that's it. Anytime there's negativity in the Torah, the fallback position is that the people responsible were the Erev Rav. Can we prove that? Do we know for sure? I mean, that's Chazal's position, but where's the proof? Okay, the Torah does not have, you know, I would argue that I don't want to say the Torah doesn't have great proofs, but those who make the Erev Rav claim don't have, in general, I think, great proofs to that suggestion. But it is a fallback position, right? I mean, similar to I remember once reading an article somebody wrote about how when you have a gap in time in the book of Bereishis, so like, you know, Yitzchak disappears for a few years after the Akedah, Yaakov disappears for a few years between the brachas and when he shows up at Laban's house. So when there's a gap in time, how do we cover for the gap in time? What do we say? Ah, Yeshiva Shemin Aver. There's no proof for that in the Torah. It's just it's an answer. But is it really the case? So here, so Rashi's first opinion is the Erev Rav, but Rashi continues and says Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh Omer beKatzinim Shebehem uBeGedolim. That what's a katzin in the Israeli army? What's a katzin? An officer. Okay, beGedolim means the great ones. And so what Rashi is saying is that the people who were struck down over here were of the greater ones. And who are they? So an answer that's given is that this is the conclusion to what took place in Mishpatim chapter 24. What happened in Mishpatim chapter 24 is that we saw that Moshe is about to go up the mountain, and at the bottom of the mountain you have Nadav, Aaron, and the Shivim Zikne Yisrael, the elders, which is a fascinating point that the elders are over there, because what we see later on in this chapter is Moshe saying, I can't handle this, I can't take care of these people by myself, and God says to him, well then you need to gather Shivim elders. 70 elders. So why? Why would that be the case? Well, that's actually a good proof to the second opinion of Rashi, which is based on what took place in Parshas Mishpatim. Mishpatim is these people, they look up and they see God. Vayiru aso Elohim. That's what the Pasuk says. They saw God. We know, lo yirani ha'adam v'chai, that you can't see God and live. So Rashi and others point out at that time that it was, because it was at the time of revelation, it was the wrong time for there to be a repercussion to what took place for seeing God at that point. So God pushed it off to a different time. In the other Navi's case, we know when they ended up dying. Okay? And some of the commentaries, including most notably of Abravanel, but there are others as well, who say that the Nadav and Avihu story of when they actually died was a smokescreen for what was really their issue, which was what took place in Mishpatim 24. The book of Shmos, chapter 24, which is the end of Parshas Mishpatim, and that the elders who saw God at that point in time, they get that same repercussion / final, you know, finality over here in this story. And Rashi is referencing that by saying it was the Katsinim Shebahem Shebigdolim, the officers, the greatest people who died at this point in time. Now, why does it have to be fire? Well, that sounds very similar to the way that Nadav and Avihu's death is described in Parsha Shmini. So, you know, let's rather than judging God and trying to figure out his ways, let's just see that there's an element of consistency here. However we want to understand it, there's an element of consistency here. We can have difficulty with it, but there is a reasonable argument to be made about what the Torah is telling us here. So that's the first story. Then we have the Asaf Suf. The Asafsuf, or the Asher B'Kibbol, these are the rabble-rousers, Hisavu Ta'ava, that they had some kind of craving. And what's their issue? They want meat. And Moshe doesn't even know how to deal with this. The fact of the matter is that Moshe, I mean, in a certain sense, he just can't relate to their complaints. He talks about how there's mun, and what the Torah describes what the mun is, and how the mun is just, you know, the most incredible kind of food. Forget about what you were taught as a child with respect to the mun. And how it could taste like, you know, you decide you want it to taste like rum raisin ice cream, it tastes like rum raisin ice cream. If you want it to taste like, you know, the best juicy steak you've ever had, you know, it could taste like that. If you want it to taste like rum raisin ice cream on top of your juicy steak, it could taste like that too. I mean, forget about that for a second. I want to share with you what Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch writes, because I just found this to be, you know, reasonable. He says here, it's Leiman. That's a response to Facebook. Okay, got it, Uncle? Okay. So this is what he says. The mun was kezera gud. Zera gud means it was appealing to the eye, round and pearl white. He describes how the word ve'eno in Pasuk Ches, Pasuk Zayin, ve'eno ke'en abedolach, something that makes an impression, is referred to as ayin. Ayin means an eye. So if we compare the other places where ayin occurs in this sense, we find that the subject there is always a shiny object. And he brings a number of examples from the book of Yechezkel, ke'en choshes kalol, ke'en tarshish, ke'en akerach hanora. And since according to Rashi, the word bedolach is crystal, the pasuk is telling us, is describing the transparency of the mun. He goes on to describe that the mana didn't come to them without any effort on their part, but rather as a result of activity. The term shatu indicates that this activity was not monotonous. They had to go in various directions in order to obtain the mana, and this provided mental stimulation. Okay? Fascinating. Going out of your house to go do something, to seek something, is good for the mind. And if it's good for the mind, it's good for the health. Okay? Being shut up at home is not good for anybody. Everybody needs to venture outside. That's important. Okay? That was a little subtle hint for what's going on today. Anyway, they ground it fine or pounded it. That's v'tochanu varichayim. They ground it fine or pounded it to coarse flakes. They ate it cooked or baked. The various ways of preparing the mun for consumption ensured that it was not lacking in variety. I like to, lahavdil, I don't think that mun was soy, but I like to compare it to the way people use soy today to create veggie burgers and veggie this and veggie this and soy sauce. And I mean, it's many uses. Think about it in that way, but, you know, multiply it manifold. And then he says that the continued way that it's described, what is leshed? Leshad, hold on. Oyatamo. Okay, which translates the taste was like that of an oil cake. So again, Hirsch says, Lashad occurs elsewhere only in Tehillim, Nepach Lashadi, where it denotes moisture and bodily fluids. Accordingly, here too, Lashad would denote the richness of oil, the moisture of oil. In Shemos 16:31, when man is first introduced to us, we're told the taste of man is described as Kesapikris Bidvash, which is some kind of honey cake. Here it does not say what its taste was, but it says v'haya ta'amo, that its taste was kitam, similar to the taste of l'shad ha-shamen. So he says here, Rashbam explains this was the taste of mun after it was cooked or baked, whereas there in Parshas B'Shalach, the pasuk describes the taste of mun eaten raw. Okay, so mun had variety in terms of its taste, in terms of its texture, in terms of how it could be prepared. It could be eaten raw, it could be eaten cooked, it could be eaten fried, it could be eaten baked. It just had that flexibility. I hope you can see me. You've all frozen. Okay, sorry about that. I hope that the internet didn't lose you, but I'm getting a low network connection on all my things. This is really disturbing. Okay, anyway. So it had that flexibility, and as a result, you know, Moshe is unable to relate to the complaints that the people have. And he goes on to say, and I just don't know what to do with these people. I can't handle them. I can't carry their burden. I didn't give birth to them. I didn't even want this job. And, you know, and God's response is, okay, And Moshe says, by the way, and if it's not going to change, then kill me now. Okay? So what happens as a result? God doesn't want Moshe dead. And so God says, all right. And he kills the people who eat the meat that ends up coming. The ones who are the most, I guess, prolific in the sense of consuming this meat and complaining. So it's a frightening tale in a sense of just, you know, the degradation of the people through their inability to you know, adjust to their change of circumstance. Now, what does that mean? I mean, so is it their fault? I don't know. Did Moshe train them properly to say, hey guys, we're going to be leaving from the mountain and things are going to be a little different, and maybe you're not going to see the mountain in the background, so it's not going to feel, we're not going to feel as connected as to God as we were before, and it's going to be a little more challenging, because we're, as opposed to being stuck in one place and in a way that we've kind of been used to, because we've been here for the better part of a year, now we're going to be moving, and our future is going to be dependent upon how we, you know, the attitude that we have in our travels. So Moshe is not ready for this travel either. I mean, the fact that people start complaining, you know, and Moshe almost falls apart seems to indicate that there is a general problem with the way that the people are on the one hand not trained for travel and not ready versus you know, just the strange reality of being on the road. There is one more tale here, which you know, is a cross between is it good, is it bad? But it's the story of the gathering of the 70 elders, and Eldad and Medad, who there's a whole story behind them, whether they were supposed to be part of the 70 elders, whether they were not included. If there were 6 elders to be picked from each tribe, and there are 12 tribes, then you get the number 72, and 2 of them would necessarily not be included, because if you have to get this magic number 70, then you're not going to have 72. And so there was a lottery box of some kind that had in it 70 pieces of paper that said, you know, you're now one of the Zakanim, and 2 that were blank. And so 70 people had taken them, and Eldad and Medad did not take them. And they just assumed that since there were 2 left, they must have been the empty ones, when in fact they weren't the empty ones. There are a lot of different theories about Eldad and Medad, but the fact of the matter is that Eldad and Medad remain behind in the camp, and they are prophesying. Okay? And it bothers Yehoshua. There are differences of opinion as to what they were possibly prophesying about. I think Rashi may mention it. It's certainly in the Gemara, and one of those things that they were prophesying is that Moshe is going to die and Yehoshua is going to take over. Now, mind you, the spies hadn't happened yet, and so Moshe is still 80-81, and we're 40 years away from almost 40 years away from Moshe's death. But Yehoshua is listening to this. This is terrible, and so he says to Moshe, "You have to, depending on how you understand what Yehoshua says, kila'aim. Does that mean imprison them? Kila'aim. Does that mean destroy them? Does it mean that they need to be, you know, put in jail, excommunicated, or executed? I mean, it's fascinating stuff. And what's Moshe's response? Moshe's response is unbelievable, but it's so part and parcel of who Moshe is, because Moshe, as we're soon going to find out, is the humblest of people. And Moshe's response is, you know what? I wish everybody were to be a Navi. Guess what? If everybody were a Navi, I wouldn't have to deal with all this stuff on my own. Everybody could get the answers that they need. So Moshe's not as upset about it as clearly Yehoshua is, but it's this story which is the lead-in, at least from Rashi's perspective, into the next story. And it's that next story that I really wanted to conclude with, because it's indicative of how far things can go, not so much in a communal sense, because it has nothing to do with community, but it has to do with the idea of Lashon Hara and how people can take things that they don't know about and just jump to conclusions which are erroneous and even wrong. And the reason why the Eldad and Medad component is thrown in here is because of the connection that Rashi and others try to make between Eldad and Medad and what Miriam ends up doing here. So I just want to summarize, why did I go through all of that if I wanted to focus on this? Okay, and the answer is because it's all part and parcel of what it means when there is of what can happen when proper lines of communication do not exist between people and leadership. However we want to define leadership and however we want to define people, and the relationship that's supposed to exist, right? It's very easy for people to complain, and it's very easy for people to blame. But more important is for people to have conversations. And conversations is very much lacking in our society in general. People just see things in their own black and white, in their own, this is the way and I can't budge, and this is the way and I can't budge, when we forget that, you know, there's elements of truth to this side and there's elements of truth to this side, and what our job is to try to figure out how we can all live together. And it shouldn't be people against each other. Moshe's complaint, when the people come complaining to him, he turns to God and he says, I don't know how to deal with this. Well, I'm supposed to deal with this alone? You know, one of the a few years ago, I gave a shiur on the death of Miriam, and one of the points that I just kind of discovered was that Miriam dies and the people come complaining to Moshe and Aaron, there's no water. Okay, and Moshe and Aaron are like, hold on a second. We're in the middle of Shiva for our sister. Like we're kind of in mourning. You know, we know that you need water, but like how about Hamakim Yinachim Eschem Esok Shevel Yitzchem Yerushalayim, right? Or whatever. I mean, they wouldn't have said that at that point in time. But how about a little bit of empathy? How about a little bit of, hey Moshe, we know you lost your sister. When you're ready, we have an issue we'd like to discuss with you. Okay, they don't have that. It's a really, and that's, you know, and that's what's going on in the world today, in basically everything. There's no conversation. The people who are the leaders, they think that they know everything, and so they treat everybody else like stupid idiots. And the people who actually are a little more intelligent than they're being given credit for are saying, hold on a second, like why are you guys making decisions? You know we elected you, but that doesn't mean you're smarter. It means that you represent us. That's what it means in the United States of America. No. We're elected, so we're smarter. Come on. That's not how it works. You need to have a conversation. Unfortunately, people need to have town halls. And we don't get town halls. And it's as a result, people just brood in anger. Like, take a look at the example that the Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch said of people needing to go out in order to have that mental inspiration that can give them mental health, which they need. So Rashi makes the connection, and all this complaining is because people just didn't know how to deal with their new reality of leaving from picking up from a place that they had gotten used to, and now how do we travel with one another and make do? How do we survive this? Yeah, Joan. Okay, right. So Moshe was very willing to give up, and Moshe was perhaps the first, but he was not the last. Right? Yirmiyahu told God to kill him, to kill himself. He was like, I can't deal with these people. Yonah, famously, right? Yonah sits outside of Nineveh, watching the city not get overturned, and Yonah's like, God, kill me. I can't deal with this. Okay, because he knows what's going on back in where the Bnei Yisrael are. So. The transition that happens is Miriam speaking about Moshe, and Rashi makes the point that she heard Tzipora talking to Moshe, talking just aloud when she heard that Eldad and Medad were now prophets. She says, "Oy, woe is to their wives, because now they're going to stay away from them, just as my husband is staying away from me." Okay. So that's fine. That's it's an interpretation, and of course, understanding that idea, helps understand Miriam's hypothetical question. Harak ach b'Moshe diber. It's pasuk beis diber Hashem. Halo gam banu diber. Does God only speak with Moshe? Doesn't He also speak with us? Vayishma Hashem, and God heard. Okay. Now the problem with that narrative is that what Miriam said, in the scheme of things, doesn't make much sense. The pasuk says the following: Perek Yud Beis Pasuk Aleph. Vatadaber Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe. Miriam and Aaron spoke regarding Moshe al odos, with respect to ha'isha hakushis asher lakach ki isha kushis lakach. So, with respect to the Cushite woman that he had taken for he had taken a Cushite woman. Okay? Now, Zipporah, as we know, was a Midianite. Okay? Midian is Saudi Arabia today. Cushite is assumed to be Cush, and Cush therefore means somewhere in Africa. Ethiopia, perhaps, is that the definition? But in either case, what we understand from what Miriam is saying is that we don't know what she's talking about. We don't know what she's talking about. Now, Rav Hirsch, when he looks at this story and at this language, he says something which I found to be rather interesting. Okay, what he says, the way that he describes this, first, before he gets into what I would say is probably a little bit more troubling commentary, is he's trying to understand what this phrase ki isha kushis lakach means. Isha kushis lakach. And what they explain, it is, one second, this is what he says. The idea, I'm going to go to his conclusion. All that remains is to explain the words ha'isha kushis asher lakach according to their unequivocal meaning. We would venture to offer a theory that to us does not seem impossible. The expression l'kichas isha kushis is nothing but a descriptive term for marriage without sexual relations. The term kushi occurs several times in a characteristic sense. It gives examples, and it denotes, So the idea, look, to make a long story short, he says that marriage with a kushit is considered, I'm not going to defend Hirsch in terms of what he's talking about, but in terms of his using examples of biblical language, marriage with a kushit is considered unnatural and intolerable. Hence, if someone married a woman and yet lived apart from her, it would be said of him that he married an isha kushit. Okay? In other words, Hirsch's definition, first and foremost, is that the idea of taking an isha kushit means that he's not having marital relations with his wife. Period. Okay, then he goes on to use, you know, metaphors to explain it, and that's, you know, that's what he goes on, you know, that's how he describes it. Now, of course, if that's the case, then, you know, why doesn't Miriam just say that? Why does she say what she says? What's this isha kushit that she's talking about? Rashi says something a little crazy, that when God appears to Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam in Pasuk Dalet, look at Rashi. He says, "Nigla alehem pisom." He appeared to them suddenly. V'heim tameim b'derech eretz, and they are tame in the sense of the way of the world. What does that mean? It means that Aaron and Miriam, with their own spouses in this moment, were engaged in an activity that would make them tame. Okay, what would that be? Marital relations. And they were screaming for water to indicate that what Moshe did was good. In other words, what's Aaron and Miriam? They need it, if they're going to go before God, presumably they need water to purify themselves. Whereas Moshe, who's not engaged in this activity, doesn't need to purify himself. And God is basically making the proof in the pudding, saying, you need to be, Moshe needs to be available at all times. Clearly, when I called you, you guys weren't available because you're not ready. You need to go through a mikveh, let's say, to become ready and available. Okay? So, but how are we to understand the isha kushis? Right? In other words, if it means what Hirsch says, what Hirsch says, that it's referring to the idea that Moshe is not engaged in marital relations. Okay, fair enough. So why doesn't it just say that? Maybe the Torah wants to speak in more pure language. That's very possible. Okay, I will tell you just in terms of interpretation, and I'm going to share with you in the chat a link which I think you'll find interesting. But I will tell you that there is a book entitled Divrei Yamim Shel Moshe, cited by a number of commentaries. Ibn Ezra thinks that the book is a phony and it's a forgery, but Rashbam, Targum Yonatan, Daz Zakenin, Rabbanel, Rabbi Chaim Paltiel, and others quote it, and we're familiar with a lot of the tales that appear in it because they are taken basically from Midrashim, and one of them describes how Moshe lived and actually ruled in the land of Cush for 40 years, after having been exiled from Egypt when there was a price on his head, symbolically marrying the queen, former wife of King Nicanor, though Moshe lived separately from her throughout his reign, which actually fits in line with what Rav Hirsch said, that Ki Isha Kushis Lakach means that he took her, but he never consummated a marriage. So they claim, those commentaries and the Divrei Yom Shel Moshe, they claim that Miriam was referring to that incident, while others say that, of course, that the Isha Kushis refers to Tzipora. But still others, such as Yosef Ibn Kaspi, suggest that Moshe had taken his second wife at that time, either in addition to Tzipora or after his marriage ended, either through divorce or possibly through her death. Okay, now, those are all possible explanations. Here is the link. One second, let me put it there. Here is the link to this article that I found, which I thought is extremely thorough when it comes to looking at this question of the Isha Hakushis. Who is this Isha Hakushis, and what does it mean? But if we do look at that link, for example, I want to go to its conclusion. Okay. Actually, I don't want to. You read it, because it kind of covers a lot of the things which I said. So I'm not going to read it now in the interest of time. But what I wanted to say was just a comment about what's going on in the country today with respect to this story here. We don't know what Miriam was saying. Okay, was Miriam talking about, in fact, a separation from a marriage? Was Miriam talking about a woman who's from a different nation and who doesn't look like the Bnei Yisrael, doesn't look like Moshe? Honestly, we don't even know what the Bnei Yisrael look like, right? Every time I see, I just got a new book from Art Scroll, and I'm not knocking Art Scroll per se, but some of their illustrators don't exactly get it when it comes to some of the things that they put together. And it, you know, it's a nicely done book, and it combines like Parsha and Midrash, and it's for kids. And so the illustrations have the Bnei Yisrael dressed in like Talmudic era garments, and they all have like payas and beards, and they look as white as European people look, and pays no attention to the fact that Avraham came originally from the Middle East. And his whole family was from the Middle East, and what do people look like at that time in the Middle East? Who knows? I don't know the answer to these questions, but there's an element of a certain kind of look. I'll use a nice word that they're trying to achieve, and I think that in that sense it falls a little short of what we could be achieving here in depicting the Bnei Yisrael, were we to actually think that going that route were beneficial. So, once again, and you can look at what Rav Hirsch says, he does talk about an element of what's called natural versus unnatural, but I'm going to take him at his word in the sense of using a biblical term rather than in the sense of a racial terminology. I would say, for example, that an Israelite with a Canaanite is unnatural. It's not to say that people can't love each other and they couldn't be together, but there is a question of what does it mean to have relationships, and I'm not talking sexual anymore, but relationships with people who are not like you, and what that means. And I'm a very firm believer that the words which Martin Luther King Jr. uttered are the closest thing to prophecy that we'll see in our lifetime, which is that people are to be judged by not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And I don't know what Miriam is talking about, and I readily admit that. And for Miriam to call into question whatever it is that she's finding problematic in Moshe's behavior, so because there's so much commentary on it. So, and even not the commentary, because we've never heard of an Isha Kushis before, we just simply don't know what she's talking about. Okay, the main issue is, and we know this from the response that God gives, is how dare you talk about Moshe? God says, how dare you talk about Moshe? You don't know what kind of relationship Moshe is supposed to have with me, and therefore with any person. So you're making comparisons which are ill-founded and which are just wrong. And you're talking about, and how dare you talk about Moshe? So what I think is at least a twofold message. It's the dangers of Lashon Hara when we don't know what we're talking about, because that's what Miriam did. And you know, and we also have to like think about this in the context of what's taking place here. Who's Miriam talking to? She's talking to Aaron, her brother, about her other brother, whom she loves. It's a private conversation. And why would she be talking to Aaron, of all people? Because Aaron, you know, I'm concerned. How many times have any of us, if we have a sibling that we're worried about, that who are we going to talk to about it? Another sibling, right? You know, aren't you worried about our shared sibling? You know, let's have this conversation. Maybe we can help him or her. Right? That's the best of circumstances. Maybe we can work through this, or maybe we can talk to each other, and maybe we can. Maybe it's our own idiosyncrasy. Maybe we have our own issues that we just need to work out. So yeah, we need to talk about our brother, but it's staying right here. We need to talk about our sister, but it's staying right here. So is that really so terrible? So we can give answers. You know, God judges the righteous, kechut asayra. You know, He has a hairbreadth of tolerance for their discrepancies, and when they step over the line, discretions rather, when they step over the line. So fine. All that is good, and the repercussions come out here, and we see what it is. It's worthy to note, by the way, that the Torah tells us Va'ish Moshe Anav Ma'od, that Moshe is exceedingly humble. That's written in the context of when his brother is talking, when his sister and brother are talking about him, as opposed to in some other context, like when the Bnei Yisrael are saying, Moshe, you're an idiot, we don't like your leadership. I mean, that's, right? Wouldn't it be more appropriate for it to be said at that time? No, it's said over here, which is, you know, kind of thought-provoking. So anyway, the first point again is about Lashon Hara and the dangers of it, even amongst family. How to have a constructive conversation without resorting to what Miriam's going through, because it is a little too much. She's worried about Moshe. Don't you think that Moshe is doing everything that God has told him to do? And if this is something which happened in the past, if it is talking about some other woman, so what's the point of talking about it now? And if you're talking about Moshe's marital relationships, I mean, mind your own business. I don't care if you're Miriam and if you're Aaron. It's not your business. This is between Moshe and his wife, and it's between Moshe and God. So that's in terms of Lashon Hara. We need to know where the conversation is litoelis for a purpose versus when it really is just gossip. Okay, Miriam, you're jealous that Moshe is, I mean, you think that Moshe should be with his wife? So not your problem. Like, take it up with God. You're a prophet. You can do that. That's point number one. And point number two is the way that we view people. I don't know what Miriam is talking about. Is she being critical of the looks of an Isha Kushit? You know, Rashi says that just as an Isha Kushit is Kushit, right? What does Rashi say? Hold on, Rashi says, the line was, Al Shem Noya, based on her beauty, she's called Kushit. Ke Adam Hakore Esbeno Noe Kushi, Kadei Shelo Tishlot Bo Ayin Ra. Like the way that a person calls his handsome son a Kushi so that there shouldn't be an Ayin Hara on him. Ah, my son's a Kushi, because I don't want anything Chalila to take away from his beautiful looks. I mean, really? That's what that means? I don't know. You know, again, far be it from me to call Rashi into question, but I don't know what he's talking about. I'm not quite sure what he's meaning to suggest. So, all that I wanted to say is that I am of the belief that Miriam is criticized here because she went too far on a number of different respects, and one of them is talking about people in the sense of how they look, even if she's talking in tongue, and what she really means is that somebody's beautiful. And what does that mean? You know, people are people. All people are created b'tzelem Elokim. All people are created in the image of God. All people have the potential for greatness. And all people, if judged we must, should be judged by the content of their character. That's it. So, you know, the talk that's going on in the world that we have today, at least in the United States that we have today, over the way that people view others and perceive others, it's tragic. It's very sad, and I don't know what to say. You know, I read an article recently, which I'm happy to send to you. Also, I don't have the link offhand, but it was an article about how Ashkenazi Jews have to stop calling themselves white Europeans. Okay, and the point being, it was a blog on the Times of Israel. It was fascinating, and there was a link there to pictures of a lot of famous people who are Jewish, who stem from, you know, European Jewry and Russian Jewry and, you know, Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, whatever, and how they all look very, very different. I mean, just give an example: Edward G. Robinson, what's that guy, Jeff Goldblum. Like, take a look at them and compare them to just some other, I mean, you know, I look at Menachem Begin, I mean, look at David Ben-Gurion, you know, just very different everything structure. We're from everywhere in the world. And the idea that that the Jewish people have somehow turned into white slave hoarders, I mean, is crazy, okay? Because everywhere in the world up until, you know, you fit into a society that you may happen to look like, we're viewed as an ethnic minority and as a whatever. It doesn't matter. In the end of the day, if you believe in the concept of Tzelem Elokim, Miriam's completely out of line here because she's talking about people in a way that you don't belong talking about people. People are people. Everybody is created in God's image and everybody needs to be respected for who they are, what they are, until their behavior demonstrates otherwise. And then we need to find out why. Why is a person behaving that way? Is the person mentally unstable? Is the person a criminal? Is the person, you know, somebody who has issues at home, which is going on? And if we can figure that out, and if we can create a society that understands people and can therefore be tolerant, then fine. But it is not our place at any point in time to talk about people based on what they look like or judge people based on what they look like. And that's why this story is a little troubling. Everything that happens in the chapter beforehand is a judgment of people's behavior. That's how we have to ask the question, how's the person behaving and how does that work within a civil society? That's the only question. Everything else, there should be answers for and there should be tolerance for. So I think that's an important message to remind ourselves now. And it's not for me to criticize Miriam, but God criticized Miriam. And God punished Miriam over the things that she had said. What she said, I don't understand. I don't understand. But I can take from whatever it is that there's something amiss and something afoul in the way that she's referring to her brother and the woman in question, whoever she may have been. Okay, and that's nobody's business. So hopefully these two messages are things that we can relate to in terms of being very careful about how we speak to people and also being very careful about how we relate to and if judge people we must, how we judge others, especially since we always want to be judged favorably, right? We always view what we do favorably. We should also judge others favorably. And if there's a crime which is committed, so that's why Dina de Malchusa Dina, there's a law of the land, and hopefully the law of the land is relatively just, and it will take care of the injustice which is out there. And unfortunately, there is elements of injustice, but at the same time, society has to move forward. And any kind of behavior which is destructive to the society is in fact that. That's what it is. It's destructive. So Miriam's behavior was her own. She got punished in the way that she got punished. And in the case of all the examples that we saw before, all the other examples are people whose behavior was their own, and they suffered whatever repercussions for their own behavior. And that's fine. That's fine. That's the way a just society is supposed to operate. The people are responsible for their own behavior. What they do, they get their repercussions. Make good choices, you'll be fine. Make bad choices, well, then society, or in the case of the Torah, God, will come down on you in the way that has been deemed or determined to be the proper way to respond.